Jolie Booth, Korea Arts, Pavilion Gardens Cafe, a piece you're going to scratch and a piece you're going to show, the Museum of?
The Museum of Ordinary People.
And Sisterhood, yeah?
Yes.
So, well, let's start with a little description of both of those.
Mm. Okay, well, Sisterhood is a... shall I take that? Right. Sisterhood...
So she said, shall I take that, which is my recording device, but I've snatched it back.
Okay, great. So Sisterhood is a... call to disarms for women everywhere to join forces together as a worldwide women web and to stand up and feel empowered and invigorated and supportive of each other to start tackling the environmental catastrophes that are looming, the possibility of World War III, just the situation that has been bubbling away for thousands of years of patriarchy screwing all of us over, and it getting to the point where women are starting to light up, and there's definitely a movement happening of women standing up and having the confidence to make a difference, which is terrifying because whenever we did that in the past we were burnt alive at the stake. So it's got a kind of witchy theme to it, and it's looking at how when women were set against each other, calling out each other as witches, how we've evolved to now not really trust each other, but that hopefully that's changing.
The vast majority of leaders in the world at the moment creating the world we've currently got are still men.
Yeah, so it just feels like things like the Me Too movement and like there's lots of things bubbling away that have been feeling like we're percolating, like something is happening and that women are starting to bubble up in a unified way, and that I think's interesting because I think we often wait for a knight in shining armor to come in and save us, and that's still got a very kind of hierarchical feel to it, whereas what it feels like is happening at the moment is that women are working together in a much more hands-on in their own community in a more personable way, and it's not about this like one person standing above the rest but about us all holding hands and standing up together. And we've been looking at movements that have happened in the past with women stopping wars. There was a civil war in Georgia, former USSR, where Russia was causing trouble in the north of Georgia. And 2,000 women got on a train, hijacked a train pretty much, and drove the train to the front line and came and put down white scarves, which was a traditional dance that stopped the men from fighting. And all of these women from all over, all the different sides that were fighting, and it was all their mums and their sisters and their daughters, and they couldn't carry on fighting because these women were there. So looking at movements like that and thinking about how we can all work together to try and turn things around.
Now, is that Sisterhood or you're exploring?
Yeah, that's Sisterhood.
Yeah, which is in an earlier stage of development.
Very early stages. We did a scratch last night at the Marlborough, and it was really lovely. There was more going on in it than I thought there was, which is always really nice. The audience thought it was very rich and felt that there was lots of different themes and things for us to explore, and gave us lots of advice on things they'd like to see us bring to the forefront more. So really lovely. It's a wonderful process. There's quite a lot of women involved in it. We've had like 50, 60 women filling in surveys for it as part of the process, and we all went and locked ourselves away in a thatched cottage in Wilmington last week and dressed in Tudor costume and did like a live action role play game where we pretended to be these three women who were getting caught and accused of witchcraft and being locked up in a church to be burnt in the morning. And that's the premise of the show. So it's three women who are waiting their trial in the morning and they know they're going to get killed. And at first they don't trust each other or know each other. And then by the end of the night, they're holding hands, supporting each other and deciding how they're going to go out when they get taken away, what they're going to do and what they're going to say to the men who drag them away in the morning. But there'll be lots of flashes to kind of present day themes, like we come forward and talk as ourselves as well. So we've actually invented a new genre, which is called Neon Tudor. And we've got some medieval dubstep as well. So there's some bits where we break out of the medieval world and come forward and it goes all kind of techno, which I'm really excited about.
Now, as I form my next question, which is going to be long, so you can eat a bit of your millionaire shortbread and also your pucker tea here. So that's the first production, and I've got two questions here, so it's sort of two-parter. One, tell me about the second one, and tell me what specifically you gain as an arts maker by doing two in the same fringe.
Mm. Well, the second one, I just finished my cake. The second one is a development of previous work. So I did the show Hip, which was where I discovered this woman Anne's stuff in a flat that I squatted, and all her things were still left behind. That then developed into a walking tour where I toured people around Brighton, showing them the ghost version of Brighton where all the hippies, the punks and the beatniks used to hang out. And it was just really wonderful to discover these kind of different memory sediment layers to a city that I really love. And then meeting a whole other generation of people that, like, all hung out with Anne and, you know, all knew each other. And it's a whole new circle of friends that I've got who are, like, a generation above me, which has been really fun to get to know.
Anne was the woman's whose flat you discovered.
Yeah, it was her flat, and it was all her letters and diaries and stuff that I've been carrying around for the last 15 years and have become, like, a human archive of her life. So we've then looked at how other people have got archives. As I was doing this work, other people were saying, oh, I've got a collection of my uncle's stuff, or I've got, you know, I found some things in an attic. And so we have decided to create this thing called the Museum of Ordinary People. It's a pop-up museum in June, and it's going to be at the Spire for the last, well, it's the last week of May going into June, so it's the very last week of the Fringe. And we've got 10 volunteers from the public who we did a shout out, and they got in touch with us and said they had collections, and we have been meeting up with them for the last 3-4 weeks. It'll be the fourth one tomorrow, and it's 6 in total, where we're teaching and running workshops showing how to turn your archive into an exhibition. So you could do it as a live art piece the way that I did with HIP, or it could be that you do it as a, you know, a normal exhibition, or it could be that you want to do it photography or film installation. So we're looking at all the different kind of mediums that you could use, researching and thinking about, like, the history and the new movements that are happening within the archive world, and then giving them the opportunity to choose how they want to present their stories. And they're really, really beautiful stories. Like, the thing that's, it's so touching, people are going to cry. It's a really moving exhibition. Really, I love the profane in the mundane, and there's just really beautiful connections that we can all relate to that run through these stories, even though they're all very different and everyone's so different, but there's lots of unifying beautiful little things that run through it, and I love it.
I'm just reading a book about the power of silence, so while you drink your tea before it gets too cold, we're just gonna have a bit of silence here.
Oh, lovely, great.
So my second part of that question was then, are they compartmentalised, the two different productions, or are you noticing as an artist that one feeds into the other in some way, and that's a good reason to do more than one piece in a Fringe?
I feel very creatively vibrant at the moment. I'm starting to get a bit tired. I feel like I need to chill out at some point in the near future. But, I mean, on a very personal level, I spent 7 years trying to have children and doing IVF. And work, like, that was very much our whole obsession for a long time. And we reached a point, me and my partner, where we realised that it had been so all-encompassing and it was really destructive that actually we didn't want to carry on doing that anymore, and we wanted to just have our lives back. And for both of us, the moment we decided to do that, things really turned around in both of our worlds. So it's like the universe was telling us that it had other plans for us. Like, my husband's set up his own laptop repair company, and he's got his own shop now, and he loves it, and he's doing exactly what he wants to do. And I just feel like all of my creative energy that would have gone into bringing up a child has gone into my work. And so it's almost like the different projects are almost like different children. It's like, and the amount of energy I've got to put into that is huge. It's vast. It's what I would have been able to do with running around chasing a toddler about or whatever. So it feels like that's where it's coming from. There's kind of a slightly painful manic element to it that's like, yeah, where do I put this stored up energy? But I feel like I'm using it in a productive way, and it feels really powerful. They do feel connected in that I feel like there's a desire to celebrate the ordinary and to celebrate real people and community and connection and nourishing stories, and to try and empower people to, you know, make moves and steps in the world that make the world a better place in some way. So it feels like they're all kind of trying to make the world a better place with the tools that I have, which is an artist.
Maybe more tea, I don't know, it's getting cold here. I want to ask you a question about archives too, and you talked about, you used the phrase, the archive world. This is the age where we're not being allowed to forget. In fact, you know, our timelines get stuff from our archive thrust in Facebook. Do you remember this time a year ago? And suddenly it's a horrendously chosen image of someone's funeral, or, you know, an ex that we wanted to forget. Yeah. So haven't we all got archives now? And is that, you know, digitally? And is that a good thing or is that a bad thing?
Well, it's a mixed bag. So on the one hand, yeah, we all have these personal archives, but there's actually going to be a real dark age during this time, because people don't print their photos out and people don't write things down. So unless someone has the password to get into your account when you pass away, and also the desire to go through all your stuff. When you think about all the photos that are there and all the emails, people aren't going to go through them in the same way that you would a box of letters. So yes, it does exist, but in some ways, because it's not analog, there's an intangible element to it that means that it in some ways is going to get lost. I know a lot of photography archivists are worried about the lack of photos that are going to be around from this era. So in some ways there's like an abundance, but it also is going to be a kind of blip in actual stuff that we're going to have our hands on in the future. Secondly, there's, and this is part of the kind of patriarchy element, there's been this grand narrative where the elite have been building giant mausoleums, celebrating their victories for, you know, the last however many thousands of years. And what's happened recently is more ordinary people have started to become visible. And I'm a Tudor reenactor. I grew up as a Tudor reenactor, a reenactment in Suffolk. And one of the things that's really frustrating, I've always been one of the poor people. I've always lived as one of the normal, ordinary, working class people. And you can't find any pictures of what they dress like, or, you know, it's really hard to find out information about how they lived because it wasn't interesting and wasn't recorded for the people who were the winners and got to write the history books. So there's something really wonderful about creating a museum that is about ordinary people's lives and just how simple and lovely and mundane and profound they are. Right. And that's capturing something that isn't part of the great big stone giant museums that are in London at the moment.
I guess I believe that memory is really important to have an element called forgetting. Mm. And we need to be able to forget stuff and have the right to forget stuff. But remembering is the idea that it's always kind of available and you just pluck it very near to you, whereas recollection is the idea of the reason for an archive is that you put it out of memory, but you can go and get it if you need to. And I guess that's the problem I have with the age now, that if we've always got constantly available archiving, it's like a head just too full of shit, really.
Yeah, but the thing that's interesting with the archive is there's always gaps. Like, there's always huge gaps. If you're, like, with Anne's life, there's so much that I don't know about her, and that's the magic. Like, I don't want to know everything. I don't want those answers. Part of what has been so inspiring and kind of all-encompassing about it is this almost, like, private detective element of trying to, like, go, oh, yeah, and then that connects, and then that connects. And I love those moments of this synchronicity all the time when you're working with archives. And it's because humans are good at finding patterns, but it's also because you are being like a private investigator, you will start finding clues that connect. And it seems almost magic, but really it's just because you're paying attention. But it seems to be a theme that runs through everybody, everybody's excitement of uncovering an archive. It's a recurring theme. But I think the silences are part of the beauty, and yeah, people being able to fill in the gaps with their own interpretation of what things mean.
And so along a line of the beginning of that line is an idea. And then somewhere you've pointed to, people join that line and they're your volunteers and there's research. And somewhere at the end of the line is a place called the Spire and an event called the Festival, the Fringe. Yeah. What happens from now to then for people listening in that turns that into a piece of performance art?
Well, they can follow the process of what we're doing if they want to see how it's all unfolding, because it's really interesting. We're all discovering as we go along how we want to create the work and interpret the work. When we do the event at the Spire, it's going to be for a week, but the dream is for it to end up being a permanent museum. So we're going to be inviting all the important people of Brighton to try and get them to be inspired by it as well, and hopefully give us a space in Brighton. I've got my eye on the Hippodrome. That would be nice. But like some nice, lovely, empty building that we can use even just for a short time. With a view to it then even becoming worldwide, because there's all these lovely museums all around the world that have kind of popped up all over the place that are connected to each other, and putting on festivals and events, because there's lots of themes that I'd really like to explore as festivals. So things like the theme of death and talking about death, and performances and shows and talks that are around the idea of death, or mother and daughter relationships, or addiction. Like, there's lots of themes that keep coming up in people's stories that I think are worth delving into deeper. But we're on social media and everything, so you can kind of follow our stories and see how the workshops are unfolding. We're doing a lot of sharing.
But you did something from the very first version of HIP, which is, whereas say a traditional playwright may do all that research, access archives, but finally they make a selection that narrows it down to one story. Mm. You offered those stories, so you brought an archive onto a stage, and the audience could influence that. And I guess this has gone even further now, has it? That, yeah. You know, a museum is I can go where I like and I can choose what I want to see.
Yeah.
Is that something you've consciously done? You know, because you could have just turned this into a show, couldn't you?
Yeah. I mean, it's evolved organically. It's in responses to people. So where I've kept meeting people who've got collections themselves, who, because one of the sessions in the workshops is to do a performance live art version, and the reaction that everyone had was absolute terror. So we've decided the best way for me to do it is for me to perform Hip to them, and then for them to see how I used it, and then maybe that might inspire them to go, oh, maybe I will give that a go. But as soon as they thought there was going to be a session where they were going to have to do performing, it really terrified people. And it's an interesting thing, because I feel like theatre or performance used to be something that we used to do collectively in a tribal way, as a way of kind of working out our issues, and it was almost like an emotional martial art that was very much part of the community that everyone was involved in. And it's been kind of cut off and given over to fame and celebrity, and it's a real shame, because that's not really what it's about. And if you actually love performing, you're on a continual journey of process. And even like if you do yoga or something, like sometimes you can do loads and you're really flexible, and other days you're just a bit stiff. And it's the same with performing. You just have to accept that when you turn up and perform, wherever you're at is wherever you're at on that particular day, and not beat yourself up and not listen to your inner critic, and let it be an adventure. And I think so much of that's been lost in the theatre world in general, but also in people's responses to the idea of performing. It's like, well, there's no one cares. Everyone wants you to do well. Like, audiences are very supportive and want you to be brilliant and be your best self. So it's an interesting thing. We're all kind of like selfie, look at me, and then when anyone's like, well, here's a spotlight, they're like, oh no, don't put me in a spotlight. It's a strange
and in terms of the venue, in terms of a bloody great church, then yeah. What opportunities does that create, and also what challenges in terms of a sort of living museum for an audience?
Yeah, it's huge. We have very kindly been donated scaffolding by a construction company in Brighton, who are going to put in a whole bunch of scaffolding around the pillars so that we can make enclosed off spaces. And that means that we can put up boards and make it into an interesting space. We're going to have to, like, we went in last week to have a look, and we're like, oh, we'll do this and this. And then we're like, yeah, but it completely depends on what the participants create. So even that, we're still having to wait until we're going to have to respond to what they come up with. But, I mean, that's exciting as well. We've got lovely ideas of having a big neon sign above the altar of Museum of Ordinary People, which we're going to make. And, try and make it look kind of modern and funky, but completely embracing the history that's in that space as well. It's nice to be in an old space, because it has all the atmosphere and archetypal energy that you want for it.
Yeah. I'm just imagining for a moment the world we now live in, this sort of post-traditional venue age, where we use phrases like kindly donated scaffolding. I'm thinking of some scaffolding company. Okay, I think I'll kindly donate some scaffolding to the arts. Yeah. But it does kind of also wake up the possibility that now theatre, particularly in a media age too, it can't be old, tired old glass cabinets of exhibits, can it?
No, it really can't. I think the interactiveness of this exhibition is what is key. You know, people want to be able to read letters and smell paper and feel things. Obviously, we don't want it to be in a way that anything's going to get damaged, but people want to be able to get absorbed in the stories, because part of the magic of these archives is the discovery of them. So that element needs to be in there somehow. We're going to have a installation where there's all the journals, like people can bring their journals and put them up there as a library. So it's almost like someone's life as a library. And we're going to be doing some workshops on how to write journals, thinking about like what Samuel Pepys did, for example, where he'd talk about the price of things and what clothes people wore, stuff that we might think is a bit mundane. Because that was interesting with Anne's diaries, because I've kept a journal since I was 8, and when I was reading Anne's journals, it was really interesting how little information she put in. Like, she'd talk about where she went and what she did and who she slept with and where she got drunk, but she didn't really talk about what was happening politically or how she felt about anything. And I found that interesting, because for quite a while I felt that we were really similar people, and it was only when I read her diaries sort of from beginning to end that I was like, actually my diaries are quite different to hers. The way that we work inside is quite different, which was a relief, because I was a bit worried about some of the things that happened to Anne kind of unfolding in my future. She's definitely a kindred spirit, but we want to teach people how to use journals and archive in a way that leaves interesting information for people in the future.
A challenging question, I ask it for good reasons, really, to understand the work. Do you think you've disturbed Anne's grave?
If I had, and if there was any kind of afterlife, she's doing a really bad job of letting me know it's a problem, because the synchronicity and the magic that's unfolded with how things have been discovered has been so extraordinary that it feels like there's some involvement on her part to an extent. So if there's in any way someone there with any kind of opinion, she seems completely happy with the situation. If there is absolutely no one there, then it's interesting, because there's the question of like who has the right to speak for the dead, and how long after someone's passed away does someone have the right to become involved. And it's an open-ended question. It's something that we explore a lot and we talk about a lot. I mean, one of the things is to get permission from family or friends, people who are alive. As I've done HIP and as I've done the tours, I've met loads of people that are involved in Anne's life, family and friends, and they've all added to the story. They've all felt that how I'm talking about her and how I feel about her is obviously with a lot of compassion and love, and that she probably would have found it funny, she probably would have connected with me, and so it's always been kind of positively received and supported. I'm very tentative about the way I do things. I'm not kind of bulldozing in. And she was a squatter herself, so she was unearthing people's houses and finding people's stories and stuff as well. And the fact that she wrote a journal, I think you either write a journal for yourself privately that you burn and don't ever want anyone to see, or you write journals with some sort of view of people reading them in the future. And she stopped writing her journals, I think, like 10 or 15 years before the end of her life. So she had quite a long time to get rid of them if she didn't want people to read them as well. Like, she had quite a long time to contemplate that. And they were kind of just around. So, yeah, it didn't seem like she was embarrassed by them.
So let's say you have disturbed her grave and you've got her attention and there is some sort of continuity.
Yeah.
And all that you've read and all the people you've met, do you think you've brought her some sort of development or resolution through this work?
I think so, yeah, because there's the idea of the Mexican Day of the Dead. Like, you have two deaths, the day that you die and the day the last person who remembers you dies. And I feel like I've invigorated her memory. One of the things that's interesting is when you are looking at someone's life in its entirety, it's a bit like being in the fourth dimension. So you're looking at like a person as a worm rather than slices of the present. So we experience each other in a slideshow of the present, which means if you've gone down a dark route and you've become a bit of a dick and people are upset with you, that's where they're at with you in that moment. Whereas you in your entirety might have had like 20, 30, 40 years of being an amazing human being. You did loads of wonderful stuff, and then like a bit where things went dark at the end. And unfortunately, that's the bit that people get remembered for. So it's quite nice to come back and look at someone in their entirety and be like, oh, well, they were the village darling. They were this amazing dancer. They were this really inspiring person. They were this, they were that. And then, yeah, things go unraveled a bit at the end. But most people's lives do. Like, so many people are grumpy old people in the end and, like, maybe do fall out with loved ones. Like, it's hard to kind of be on your best behaviour for a whole lifetime.
So two final questions then, to sort of bring this to a circular end in a way. One is, so if we went with that esoteric conversation that was started by your discovery of her, you know, her place of living and all of the conversations and the work, what do you think through that she's asked you most, and what have you answered?
I think the main discovery has been what her pain was, like why... Because she was in a dark place by the end, and she had so many natural talents and blessings, and how you can have all of that and it not be enough to kind of see you through to the end, which I feel a little bit like I have as well. I feel like I've got lots of, you know, brilliant things that are in my bank, so to speak, and being worried that because I live in Brighton and it's easy to be a hedonist here, like worrying that I might push things too far or like that I might be in trouble. And it's been like a two-way lesson, I suppose. For her, there's an element of healing. I mean, if she is getting anything from it, there's an element of healing, of looking at her in her entirety and celebrating the achievements that she had as well as the failings. And for me, to look at how that unravelling process happens and what warning signals I can see happened earlier on in her life that maybe I need to be aware of. And it's made me chill out a lot more. Like, I definitely drink a lot less than I used to, and yeah, it's made me much more conscious about the age that I am, and if I carry on acting like a 20-year-old, then that might be a problem.
So you've answered the question for her in a way that's answered the question for you,
yeah,
about being a human being. And then just then looking at that possible bridge between that and sisterhood,
yeah,
what have you learned yourself about being a woman from her?
Well, definitely, and this is something that's been coming up a lot in sisterhood and is kind of the point of the title of the show, women have been trained to not trust each other. And if you talk to a lot of women, they don't feel there is a sisterhood. They feel that women are bitchy and backstabbing and can't be trusted and will cut you down as soon as they get the chance to. And I think we've been made to do that. I think you think about witch trials and things like that, people outing each other, it's like slut shaming. You've got it all still going on now. You know, Hillary Clinton has the guts to stand up and say, oh, I'm going to go for president, and everyone calls her a witch and says, lock her up. Whether you agree with her or not, people still use that language. Women are still being burnt as witches today, just in different parts of the world. And I think it's interesting working out ways of unravelling that so that we can all support each other. Because Anne, Brighton attracts women who don't like men. That was something that me and my friends realised years ago. All of us... attracted women that only like men. So when I moved to Brighton, all of my friends were all tomboys, were all the girls that hung out with the guys. And we moved to Brighton and all found each other and was like, oh, actually, some women are all right. Like, we just needed to find each other. And once I got that, the nourishment I got from my girlfriends is so huge and feels so empowering. And it makes me sad that some women still haven't experienced that and don't have that in their lives. And Anne was definitely one of them. Like, she was a ferocious, argumentative, sexual woman who spent all her time hanging out with men and wowing them and sleeping with them and having a marvellous time. But it didn't, like, she had some really close female friends, but it didn't feel like she was very connected to the sisterhood. And I think that's the thing, is that the powerful kind of wise women who probably would have been burnt as witches are a little bit on their own and isolated. And then there's this kind of, yeah, bitchy sisterhood that kind of is there on the sidelines, kind of being catty. And so it's trying to heal all of that, finding ways that we can build each other up and support each other and empower each other when we do have the guts to stand up and say something, to not be like, oh, who does she think she is? But, like, good on you. Yeah, well done. That's a scary thing to do.
Thanks for talking to Fringe Review.
No worries.